I mean, we call them funny stories. And funny is good, right? Well, yes, if the funny is really funny, but sometimes it isn't. Should we even conduct any inquiry into the nature of humor or the concept of humor? Many people simply aren't amused by the whole attempt to analyze why things are funny. In 2006, Deborah Solomon, a reporter for the New York Times Magazine, interviewed Chris Rock, who's easily one of the funniest people working in America today and was at the time also. This was part of an entire issue about comedy. And Solomon started her interview with Rock this way. This issue is devoted to comedy, so let's get right to the point. What makes someone funny? And Rock answered, "That's not funny. You want to know what's not funny? Thinking about it." Now, one person who spends a lot of time thinking about humor is a gentleman named Professor Stephen Gimbel of Gettysburg College. He's a professional philosopher, and also at one time, he had a side job as a stand-up comic, although he doesn't do that any longer. He gave a series of lectures called "Take My Course, Please, The Philosophy of Humor," distributed by the Teaching Company, which those of you who know me might know that that's easily my favorite online retail establishment ever. Gimbel tells us during his course of lectures that there are five standard philosophical theories about humor and what makes something humorous. And by the way, some thinkers, including Gimbel himself, draw a distinction between things that are humorous on the one hand and things that are funny on the other hand. I will tell you, I don't see a viable distinction between those two things, so I will use those two terms interchangeably, even though Gimbel would not approve, I'm sure, if he were here. Here are the standard theories about humor as Gimbel summarizes them. There are five. First, superiority theory. And that holds that to joke is to mock, and to mock is to put someone or something down beneath our level. Second, inferiority theory, according to which a joke can be a form of acceptance, empathy, and solidarity, laughing with somebody, that is, the target of the joke. Third, play theory, according to which humor is a species of the general phenomenon of play. If someone's joking, they say they're only playing around. Four, relief theory, which says that humor is the result of the mind summoning up energy to solve what it sees as a problem, only to realize it's a joke and that it doesn't need all that energy. The body then releases that extra energy as explosive laughter. And fifth, incongruity theory, according to which the central concept involved in creating humor is incongruity, two things that clash with each other. Often jokes are set up with certain expectations that are suddenly undermined at the end. Now, Gimbel then adds his own theory about what makes for humor, and the reason he adds his own theory is in his discussion of the five standard theories, he obviously does not agree with those or that any of them is sufficient at all. Now, I have my own criticisms about those standard theories. They're not exactly the same as Gimbel's. In my view, the standard theories are at the same time over-inclusive and under-inclusive. They're over-inclusive by including things that aren't funny, and they're under-inclusive by excluding things that are funny. Now, we can think of examples of things that aren't funny that do fit one or more of those definitions. Here's one. Imagine that you're listening to a sportscaster who is describing a baseball game that's going on. And during the course of that baseball game, the sportscaster describes an immaculate inning. And an immaculate inning is an inning in which the pitcher faces only three batters. There are only three at-bats. Each one of those three is struck out on three pitches each, the minimum necessary. It does happen. It's quite rare. The last time that happened was July 3rd, but it's... But it doesn't happen. I mean, there have been a lot of games that have been played since then. Now, if you listen to that, according to at least four of these theories, and probably all five, that really should be funny. I mean, after all, you have a person in a superior position. That's the pitcher. You have people in inferior positions, namely each one of those three batters who strikes out. You have a game, namely Major League Baseball. You have the release of built-up tension that occurs in a really unexpected manner. Nobody really expects that to occur. But nobody thinks that that immaculate inning is funny. I mean, depending on whether you are rooting for one team or another, you may think that inning is terrible, you may think it's great, but chances are you don't think it's funny because it isn't. And we can imagine things that don't fit into any of those five categories that are in fact funny. Think of the movie When Harry Met Sally. Anyone remember When Harry Met Sally? Oh yeah, a few had. Now, that's the movie, for those of you who may not remember it or may not have seen it. It stars Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal. It's directed by Rob Reiner. In the movie, there is a classic scene that takes place in Katz's Delicatessen in New York. Ah, some of you remember it. Now, delicacy prevents me from describing that in any great detail. Yeah, sure, were you used, we should be more relaxed about these things, but, you know, it's church, and no, I'm not going to describe it in detail. But I can say this, that in that Delicatessen scene, the Meg Ryan character demonstrates to the Billy Crystal character just how a woman might pretend to have more of a good time than in fact she's having. Meg Ryan gives a loud demonstration of this. It's audible to everybody in the delicatessen. And it's pretty funny. And there are some brief reaction shots by Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal towards each other, and those are pretty funny too. But then there's a cut to another customer at the delicatessen, a customer who is otherwise not involved with the lives of these two, is not otherwise a participant in the movie itself. She obviously had been interrupted in giving an order to her server, but after the demonstration, the cut goes back to her. And she then tells the server who's taking her order, "I'll have what she's having." Now, that line is a joke in addition to the jokes within the interaction between Ryan and Crystal. And the jokes within that interaction between Ryan and Crystal can be analyzed according to the five traditional theories of humor. But that added line, "I'll have what she's having," that doesn't fall within any of the five categories. Incongruity theory is about as close as you can get, but I don't think it holds up. I don't think it fits there or anywhere else. And even though that line does not fit in any of those five categories, it's still funny. It's the funniest line in the movie. It's one of the funniest lines in American movie history. Now, Professor Gimbel has his own theory of humor, which he calls the cleverness theory. And in his words, an act is humorous if and only if it is an intentional, conspicuous act of playful cleverness. Now, I think that's a good effort, but it's really kind of circular. This playful cleverness thing is just saying it's humorous, and so your definition goes around and around. It seems to me to qualify as a tautology, which is what you have with someone who defines a couch. A couch is any one of a number of objects that are couch-like in function and appearance. I mean, it doesn't really add a lot of information to anything at all. But honestly, I will say that in terms of defining humor, I think a tautology is about as good as we're going to get. But I've always thought that if you're going to engage in tautology, you should be open and obvious about it. And so I'll be open and obvious about my tautology dealing with humor. Funny is funny, and unfunny isn't funny. And that isn't terribly informative, but it's hard to argue with. But I think that we can say more about what isn't funny than we can about what is funny. And that's where I think the standard theories of humor do come in handy. At least one of them does. And that is the superiority theory of humor. I don't think it explains much about what's actually funny, but I think it goes a long way towards explaining what isn't funny and why. Now, a lot of people going back a long, long time in human history have employed the superiority theory of humor basically to condemn humor. What, you mean one person or group of people are lording their superiority over other people and you think that's funny? Well, so much the worse for humor. 2,400 years ago, Plato looked at humor that way and he condemned it for that same reason. Plato's student Aristotle did leave some room for what he considered to be cultivated wit, which he allowed as how was okay, but he did condemn what he called buffoons who, in their crude attempts to be humor, cause pain to the objects of their supposed humor. And let's not forget the Hebrew scriptures, which do equate humor with laughter, with scorn, with something you shouldn't do. There is Psalm 22, which contains the line, "All they that see me laugh me to scorn." And we can't forget the story of the prophet Elisha, not Elijah, but Elisha. Elisha apparently didn't have much hair on the top of his head. He was on his way to the town of Bethel, and the children of the city of Bethel saw him, and they came up with this example of insult humor. "Get lost, Baldy." Really, that's the best they could do. "Get lost, Baldy." I mean, couldn't they have done any better than that? Well, it was enough for Elisha to call upon the Lord to send two she-bears to maul 42 of the children. I guess that'll teach him. Now, I have to say I'm adamantly opposed to bear mauling for unruly children. That's not an approved form of discipline. I wouldn't endorse it under any circumstances. But there is something to be said for disapproving the Bethel children's insult humor. I mean, first of all, is it even really humor? It's a little bit like the Bethel children looking at me and calling me shorty. You know, wow, can't you think of something a little bit more wounding? I mean, it's not as if I've spent all my years thinking I was really tall, and now you've told me I'm short, and so the scales have fallen from my eyes, and I don't know if I can get up in the morning. You know, you kids are going to have to do a lot better than that. You're going to really have to step up your game if you expect me to send the she-bears after you. Now, insults can be funny. Shakespeare was good at devising clever insults. I particularly like this one from Coriolanus. It wasn't a direct insult. The person wasn't actually there at the time. But this is the comment about that person: "The tartness of his face sours ripe grapes." Now, Shakespeare wrote a lot of insults that were not funny. They were not intended to be funny. But the funny insults he wrote were funny because they were funny. They weren't funny because they were insults. Insult humor isn't funny unless it's humorous. And just berating somebody with schoolyard taunts isn't funny, and it really doesn't matter whether anybody laughs in response to it. You can find toadies and sycophants who will join in the laughter under pretty much any circumstances at all. And much of insult humor is, in political circles, just considered political discourse these days, even though it's just crude insult humor. And really, when you think about it, that kind of insult humor, or that those kinds of insults, really are simply verbal assault and battery. And if you have any assault and battery, whether it's verbal assault and battery or actual assault and battery, it doesn't get any funnier just if you add a laugh track to it. And you know, racist or sexist or misogynistic or homophobic humor and all other humor of similar ilk that targets the powerless, the oppressed, and the voiceless, well, that's just insult humor writ large. And it isn't funny any more than the small-scale insult humor is. Within the past couple of weeks, you may have heard about a report by an organization called ProPublica, and that bills itself as a nonprofit newsroom that investigates abuses of power. And their report that came out, I believe, July 1st, concerns a previously secret Facebook group of some current and former Border Patrol agents, or at least some people who claimed that they were current or former Border Patrol agents, who were sharing some images, jokes, comments, tidbits of news, and various kinds of things on this Facebook group. Now, a lot of those things, and I will not quote any of them to you today, a lot of those things are pretty sick and violent and racist. And I will add, just as I was preparing this, CNN identified another similar Facebook group, apparently catering to the same kind of clientele. Now, much of this stuff is presented as humorous, but honestly, it's really hard to imagine how anyone could think that images of sexual assault of female members of Congress might be considered amusing, but that's the kind of stuff you will find being shared in this group. Now, I mentioned the Border Patrol-related Facebook groups really because it's been hard to ignore the news about them. It's not because I believe that all or most Border Patrol agents participate in those groups or share in that so-called humor. As a matter of fact, I think that is unlikely. And I do think it's wrong to make it seem as if all Border Patrol agents are offenders, and it is similarly wrong to close our eyes to the fact that that same kind of stuff gets passed around among people from all walks of life. No profession, no calling is immune. And I have to share something that is close to home for me, and that is that judges have done this kind of thing as well. A few years ago, and you may recall hearing about this. A few years ago, a federal judge in Montana was reprimanded by the federal Ninth Circuit Judicial Council for sending an email containing a racist and misogynistic joke involving then-President Barack Obama and his mother. And there are many more cases I could tell you about, but I won't burden you with today. I believe that the more racist or homophobic or misogynistic or xenophobic a joke is, the less likely it is to be actually funny. And it's instructive to try to consider why that might be. And to do that, I'd like to tell you about the history or the probable history of the Polish jokes that used to be told, maybe they still are, but they certainly were told when I was a kid in the 1960s growing up, and they probably have been told since then as well. But it actually is possible to get a handle on when those jokes started. Hundreds of years ago, there was a nation called the Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania. At one time, it was the largest country in all of Europe. It had neighbors who, for a variety of reasons, didn't really like the Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania, and they wanted its territory. That turned out to be the primary thing that those three neighbors had against the Commonwealth. They wanted its land. There was Russia to the east, Prussia to the north and west, and Austria to the south and west. And these three empires that surrounded the Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania undertook a series of military attacks against that country in several stages, starting in 1772 and going on to 1795, 23 years later. And the upshot was that Poland-Lithuania was dismembered, and it was ultimately destroyed. Its former territory was parceled out among the victors. History professor Vejas Gabriel Lulevicius of the University of Tennessee at Knoxville refers to this dismemberment and destruction as, his words, an international criminal event, and he also called it the mugging of a country in broad daylight. And then Lulevicius notes that the conquerors, the three conquerors, they needed to come up with a cover story as to why they did this, because they had to answer in some way in the court of international public opinion. The story that they came up with and that they thereafter repeated over and over and over and over again was that the Poles were backward. They were unruly. They were uncultured. They lived chaotic lives, and they could not run their country. In short, according to the cover story, they were stupid. Does that sound like anything you've heard before? Lulevicius believes that such slanders probably, and that's his qualifier, he's not claiming that this can be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, but he is saying it's more likely true than not. Probably these slanders resulted in the Polish jokes that eventually found their way to America. The attacks on the Poles occurred first. First the military attacks, and then the verbal attacks to justify the military attacks. And then those verbal justifications morphed into what we now know of as Polish jokes. Any humorous content of those jokes turned out to be merely secondary to the original purpose for the slanders. Now, I have a theory about jokes that target vulnerable people. Those that are, according to Chet, our narrator, Chet in our reading today, designed to evoke nasty laughter just to be mean to other people. And I have to tell you, it's not going to hurt my feelings if you don't agree with my opinion, if you don't think it covers the facts. But this is my view of why those jokes are told and why they're not funny. I believe that the reason that so many jokes targeting vulnerable people are not funny is because they're not supposed to be funny. You know, if they were supposed to be funny, they would be funny, and they're not. They're not supposed to be funny because any genuine humor would just get in the way. Genuine humor has a universal humanizing effect. When people share a laugh, and not a laugh at the expense of other people, but a laugh in recognition of our common humanity, when we do that, we share something valuable. What we share at that moment may be hard to describe, but even though it's hard to describe, it's real, and it helps to bind people together. I believe that the whole point of telling a racist or homophobic or otherwise nasty little joke is to do exactly the opposite of that. The purpose of the nasty little joke is to be serious. It's not to be funny. The purpose of the joke is to let the targets of the joke get a very serious message. The message being, you're not one of us, or they're not one of us. You're never going to be one of us, and I'm not going to treat you as if you are because you're not. And the off-the-rack defense, which is, just kidding, only fooling around, can't you take a joke? Well, those are just pulled out when the racist or the homophobe or the other nasty little joke teller gets caught. And that defense really shouldn't fool anybody. It's no accident that genuine humor is often referred to as good humor. It's good humor. It's not bad humor. There's a distinction between good humor and bad humor. And to quote that great American philosopher, Mammy Yoakum. Mammy Yoakum from the classic comic strip Lil Abner by the great late Al Capp. Mammy Yoakum liked to say, good is better than evil because it's nicer.